A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He's been living in Israel about 10 years now, transferred his Irish license, passed the tests, but he genuinely hates driving here. The culture is hyper-aggressive, constant honking, getting cut off, tailgating. And the thing that really gets him is the tailgating at night. He tells his story about driving up a mountain road near the Lebanese border. Dark, winding, dangerous, and there's a guy behind him tailgating, then flashing high beams when that doesn't work. No enforcement anywhere near. And Daniel's question is, what do you actually do in that moment? Not the obvious, terrible advice like brake checking. But how do you maintain composure and safety when your brain is screaming threat?
That mountain road story, I know exactly the stretch he's talking about. Route 899, up near the border. No shoulders, cliff face on one side, drop off on the other, and the kind of darkness where your headlights feel like they're illuminating about 10 feet of road. I drove it once at night and swore never again.
It's the moment where... just ignore it. Stops being advice and starts being a joke. You can't ignore headlights filling your entire rearview mirror on a road where one mistake means you're off a mountain.
Here's why this isn't just a personal annoyance. The numbers make it a public health problem. Israel's road deaths in 2025 hit 377, up 12% from the year before. The National Road Safety Authority's annual report cites tailgating as a contributing factor in 1 in every 5 rear-end collisions. That's thousands of crashes where someone was driving too close and someone else's brain couldn't handle it.
1 in 5. So Daniel's not describing a pet peeve. He's describing a statistically significant threat that most of us face regularly and have no training for.
What makes tailgating unique among aggressive driving behaviors is that it's sustained. A cutoff is a 1-second event. Someone honks, it's over. Tailgating is a continuous threat loop. Those headlights stay there. Your brain doesn't get a break. It's threat perception, then distraction, then impaired driving, then more threat, and around it goes.
Which is exactly what Daniel's describing when he says he gets distracted and stressed the moment it starts. That's not weakness. That's neurology doing exactly what neurology does when a predator won't stop following you.
Daniel's context makes this even more interesting. He grew up driving in Ireland, a culture that is, broadly speaking, courteous, yielding, the kind of place where people flash their lights to let you merge. Then he moves to Israel, passes the tests, transfers his license, and suddenly he's in what feels like a completely different activity. It's not that he doesn't know how to drive. It's that his brain was calibrated for a driving culture that doesn't exist here.
The Dodgems metaphor he used is perfect. In Dodgems, collisions are the point. You bump into people, everyone laughs. On real roads, collisions are catastrophic. But his brain is treating the tailgater like a Dodgem opponent. Someone playing the same game by different rules. When actually, the tailgater is playing a completely different game where Daniel's car is just an obstacle.
That's the expectation mismatch. Your brain has a model of how driving works, how close cars should be, what other drivers want, what counts as normal. Daniel's model was built in Ireland. Here, the model breaks. Every tailgater is a data point that says, your model is wrong. That's cognitively exhausting even before we get to the fear.
It's culture shock at 80 kilometers an hour. Except culture shock usually means you're confused about when shops close. This version has consequences measured in braking distance.
Israel is a useful extreme case because the driving culture is so consistently transactional. In Ireland, yielding signals cooperation. Here, yielding often signals weakness, and someone will take the gap you left before you finish processing that you left it. The entire grammar of the road is different.
Which makes it the perfect laboratory for tailgating. If you can handle it here, you can handle it anywhere. But Daniel's question isn't how do I change the culture? It's what do I do in the moment when my brain is screaming and the headlights won't back off?
The first thing to understand is that what's happening in your brain is not a failure of willpower. It's a mechanism called attentional capture. When a threat appears and your brain categorizes headlights filling the rearview mirror as a threat, your salience network hijacks your executive function. You literally cannot think clearly about lane positioning or speed modulation because your amygdala is running the show.
The stress isn't a side effect. The stress is the mechanism. The tailgater has, without touching your car, taken partial control of your brain's operating system.
That's why tailgating is different from a honk or a cutoff. Those are acute. Tailgating is chronic. It sustains. Your brain never gets the signal that the threat has passed, so it never downregulates. You're stuck in a stress loop, you fixate on the mirror, your driving gets worse, the tailgater gets more impatient, the threat intensifies.
Daniel's Dodgem's frame makes it worse, because Dodgem's implies an opponent, someone whose behavior you can influence. But the tailgater isn't playing the same game. They're not responding to you as a person. You're an obstacle between them and wherever they're going. Treating them as an opponent gives them a status they haven't earned.
That's the cognitive trap. Your brain wants to solve the tailgater's impatience. Speed up, move over, do something to make them stop. But their impatience is not your problem to solve. Every time you try to solve their emotional state, you hand them more control over yours.
Let's walk through what happens in that moment. Daniel's on the mountain road. Headlights appear in his rearview mirror. Close, then closer. His salience network fires. The amygdala says threat. And suddenly his eyes are locked on that mirror.
The University of Groningen published a study on this in 2024. They put drivers in simulated tailgating conditions and tracked their gaze patterns. The results: a 40% increase in fixation on the rearview mirror and a 30% decrease in scanning the side mirrors. You're literally losing peripheral awareness. On a winding mountain road, that's catastrophic. You need to be scanning for animals, debris, the edge of the road.
The tailgater isn't just behind you. They're inside your decision-making loop. Your brain is spending 40% more time looking backward, which means 40% less time processing what's ahead. And the side mirror drop-off means you're losing the very information you need to change lanes or pull over safely.
That's attentional capture in action. The threat in your peripheral vision triggers what neuroscientists call exogenous attention. It's involuntary. You can't choose not to notice it. And once it's captured your attention, your executive functions, planning, decision-making, impulse control, all degrade. Your prefrontal cortex gets overruled by your amygdala.
Which is why, just ignore it is neurologically incoherent. You can't ignore a threat your brain has already flagged. What you can do is redirect, but that's a trained skill, not a default setting.
This is where the bad advice starts to make a weird kind of sense. Your brain is screaming, do something, so you speed up. That's the compliance trap. The tailgater wants you to go faster, you go faster, and your brain gets a brief moment of relief. The distance increased, the threat receded. But what actually happened? You just taught that tailgater that tailgating works.
You've become a training mechanism for bad behavior. Every time someone speeds up because they're being tailgated, they reinforce the exact behavior that made them miserable. Multiply that across thousands of interactions, and you get a culture where tailgating is rational, because it gets results.
There's the practical danger too. You're on a mountain road, already near the speed limit, and now you're speeding up. Your reaction time hasn't improved. Your visibility hasn't improved. You've just reduced your margin for error on a road with no margin to begin with.
The other instinct is to move over. On a highway with a clear shoulder or passing lane, that can work. But Daniel's mountain road had neither. Moving over there means putting your tires on gravel or into a ditch, or worse. The compliance instinct doesn't distinguish between safe and unsafe escape routes. It just wants the threat gone.
That's the trap in its purest form. Your brain is trying to solve the tailgater's impatience. But their impatience is not your problem to solve. Your responsibility is to drive safely. And sometimes driving safely means not accommodating them.
Which brings us to the brake check myth. Daniel flagged it himself. Clearly a horrific idea. But let's actually do the physics, because people need to understand why it's not just rude, it's lethal.
At 100 kilometers an hour, a typical driver has a reaction time of about half a second. In that half second, before you even begin to brake, your car travels 14 meters. Now imagine the tailgater is two car lengths behind you. They're already too close to stop safely if you brake normally. If you brake check them, a sudden, sharp deceleration, you've removed their reaction window entirely.
14 meters of unreactive travel. That's the length of a bus, and the tailgater hasn't even touched their brake pedal yet.
Then the chain reaction. The tailgater slams their brakes. The car behind them hits them. Now you've got a multi-car pileup, and you caused it. Legally, in Israel, brake checking falls under Section 3038 of the Penal Law, endangering life on the road. That's not a traffic ticket. That's potential criminal charges.
You've escalated a non-physical threat into a physical collision, potential injuries, and a criminal record. And for what? To teach someone a lesson they probably won't learn anyway.
The moral dimension is worth stating plainly. When you brake check, you're using your vehicle as a weapon. You're taking a situation where no one has been physically harmed and introducing the possibility of physical harm. That's not self-defense. That's escalation.
Every instinctive response to tailgating is either dangerous, counterproductive, or both. You reward the behavior and reduce your safety margin. Move over unsafely? You trade one threat for another. You create a collision. What's left?
There's a technique that the UK's Institute of Advanced Motorists teaches. It's called flash and fade. And it's counterintuitive because it involves slowing down, which feels like the opposite of what you should do when someone is riding your bumper.
Slowing down when someone wants you to go faster. That does sound counterintuitive.
Here's how it works. At night, when someone is tailgating you, you briefly flash your rear fog lights. Not your brake lights, that's critical. Just once. The fog light flash signals, "I see you." It breaks the anonymity that fuels a lot of aggressive driving. The tailgater realizes they're not just following a car, they're following a person who is aware of them.
It's de-escalation through acknowledgement. You're not threatening them. You're not punishing them. You're just saying, "I know you're there."
Then, over about 10 seconds, you gradually reduce your speed by 5 to 10 kilometers per hour. Not suddenly, that would be a brake check. What this does is force the tailgater to either pass you or back off. If they can pass, they will. If they can't, they'll create distance because they don't want to go even slower.
The gradual part matters because a sudden slowdown triggers their fight response. A gradual slowdown just makes tailgating you less rewarding. They're not getting what they want. They're getting less of it.
The beauty of flash and fade is that it doesn't require the tailgater to be reasonable. It doesn't require them to become a better person. It works on the most basic behavioral level. Tailgating stops being effective. They either pass or they back off. Either way, they're not on your bumper anymore.
Flash and fade works when you've got fog lights and some road to work with. But let's go back to Daniel's actual situation. Cliff on one side, drop on the other. There's nowhere to pull over. The most common advice, just pull over and let them pass, assumes a safe place exists. What do you do when it doesn't?
This is the pullover paradox. The safer the road, multi-lane highway, wide shoulders, the easier it is to pull over. The more dangerous the road, mountain pass, single lane, no shoulder, the harder it is. The advice fails exactly where you need it most.
Which means Daniel, on that road near the Lebanese border, had no good options in the conventional playbook. You can't pull over because there's nowhere to pull over to. You can't speed up because the road is winding and dark. You can't brake check because that's attempted murder with extra steps.
The solution is something you do before the tailgater appears. Pre-identify escape points, lay-bys, gas stations, turnoffs, even a wide section of gravel. Anything that could serve as a safe place to let someone pass. You scan for these constantly, the way you scan for hazards. When a tailgater appears, you already know where your next exit is.
That's the proactive version. But on Daniel's road, even that might not help. Some stretches have nothing for kilometers. If no escape point exists, the controlled slow is your only option. You gradually decelerate, not to punish, not to communicate, but to reduce the energy of any potential collision. At 50 kilometers an hour, a rear-end impact is survivable. At 80, it might not be.
That's a grim calculus, but it's the real one. You're trading the tailgater's impatience against physics. You can't control their following distance, but you can control the speed at which any impact would happen. That's not surrender. That's harm reduction.
Even if you've got the physical tactics down, there's still the problem inside your skull. How do you stop your brain from fixating on those headlights? The Groningen study showed why 40% more mirror fixation. How do you break that loop?
This is where the mirror game comes in. It's a reframe from sports psychology. Instead of treating the rearview mirror as a threat monitor, you treat it as a peripheral awareness tool. You check it every 5 to 8 seconds, not constantly, and you immediately return your focus to the road ahead. The rhythm is what matters. It's not don't look, it's look on schedule, not on demand.
You're replacing compulsive checking with discipline checking. The tailgater doesn't get to control when you look.
Here's the key. You have to practice this on calm drives first. You can't learn it while you're stressed. Set a mental rhythm. Use your car's interval wipers as a cue if that helps. Make the 5 to 8 second mirror check automatic so that when the headlights appear, your eyes go to the mirror on schedule, not because the threat pulled them there.
It's like any trained response. You don't learn to throw a punch during a fight. You learn it in the gym so it's there when you need it. Same principle applied to where your eyes go.
That brings us to the deeper cognitive work. Daniel's Dodgem's metaphor. It's vivid and useful, but it's also wrong in a way that makes the stress worse. Dodgem's implies an opponent. An opponent is someone whose behavior you can influence, someone you're in a contest with. The tailgater is not your opponent. They're not even thinking about you as a person.
That's the narrative reframe. Instead of this guy is attacking me, I tell myself this is a toddler in the backseat having a tantrum. A toddler screaming doesn't want anything rational from you. You can't soothe them by driving differently. Your job isn't to make them stop screaming. Your job is to keep driving safely while they scream.
That shift from opponent to irrelevant noise source. It's not just a nice idea. Stanford researchers tested this in 2023. They had drivers in simulated tailgating scenarios. One group was told to reframe aggressive drivers as annoying weather rather than personal threats. Their cortisol levels were 25% lower than the control group. Same situation, same tailgater, completely different physiological response.
You don't get angry at rain. You don't try to teach rain a lesson. You don't speed up to appease rain. You adjust your driving for the conditions and you keep going. The tailgater is weather. Annoying, potentially dangerous weather, but weather.
The toddler metaphor and the weather metaphor do the same cognitive work. They move the tailgater from agent who is doing something to me to condition I am navigating through. That reframe is what breaks the stress loop. Your amygdala stops treating the headlights as a predator and starts treating them as an environmental factor.
Which is the difference between I am being attacked and this road has a tailgater on it? One is personal, one is just the conditions, and conditions you can handle.
There's one more piece to this, and it's the one that makes me angry. The enforcement gap. On roads like Route 899 near the Lebanese border, there is essentially zero traffic enforcement. No fixed cameras, rare patrols, no automated following distance measurement. Daniel mentioned it himself. You're not going to see any enforcement up there.
It's not just remote roads. Even on highways, tailgating enforcement is rare because it's hard to prove. You need video evidence of following distance sustained over time. A patrol car seeing someone drive too close for 3 seconds isn't enough to write a citation that holds up. So the behavior persists.
The practical implication is harsh but important. The solution has to be entirely driver-side. You cannot rely on external intervention. No police car is going to appear and make the tailgater back off. Accepting that is frustrating, but it also clarifies things. The only tools that matter are the ones you carry in your own head.
Which is why we've just spent all this time on cognitive reframes and trained responses. It's not because we prefer psychology to policy. It's because on that mountain road at night, psychology is all you've got.
Let's distill this into things you can actually do. 4 concrete takeaways for the next time those headlights fill your mirror.
Starting with the one that sounds like basic safety, but is actually a stress management tool. The 3-second following distance rule. Everyone learns it for the driving test, then most people ignore it. But when you're being tailgated, maintaining 3 seconds from the car ahead of you isn't just about not hitting them. It creates a buffer.
That buffer is everything. If you've got 3 seconds of space in front of you, you can gradually decelerate when someone's on your bumper without panic braking. You're not reacting to 2 threats simultaneously, the tailgater behind and the car ahead. You've eliminated 1 variable. And that buffer also gives the tailgater room to pass when an opportunity opens up.
It's the difference between I'm trapped between 2 cars and I've got options. The tailgater wants you to close that gap because it feels to them like you're making progress. Keep your buffer. It's your maneuvering room and your stress relief valve in one.
Second takeaway, and this one you do before you even start the engine. Pre-commit to a no-escalation policy. Decide now, in your driveway, that you will not brake check, you will not speed up to appease, you will not gesture. It's a one-time decision that eliminates dozens of micro-decisions under stress.
This is the one that saved me the most mental energy. When the tailgater appears, there's no internal debate about whether to respond. The decision was already made. I'm not going to engage. That's not cowardice. It's conserving cognitive bandwidth for the decisions that actually matter, like where the next turn is and whether there's gravel on the road.
The science backs this up. Decision fatigue is real. Every should I do something? Moment under stress burns glucose and degrades your next decision. Pre-committing removes the question entirely. You've already answered it. Now you just drive.
Third takeaway, the 5 to 8 second mirror check drill. We talked about the rhythm replacing the compulsion, but the practical version is this. Practice it on calm drives until it's automatic. Use your interval wipers as a metronome if your car has them. The point is that when the stress hits, your eyes go to the mirror on schedule, not because the headlights yank them there.
I've started doing this on my commute into Jerusalem. It's remarkable how quickly it becomes background rhythm. The first time I got tailgated after practicing it, I realized I'd checked the mirror, registered the car, and returned to the road ahead without the spike of adrenaline. The check happened because it was time to check, not because the threat demanded it. That's the shift.
It sounds small, but that's the whole point. You're not fighting your brain's threat response. You're routing around it with a trained behavior that starves the attentional capture loop. The headlights don't get to be the thing that controls your gaze.
Fourth takeaway, and this is the one that changed things for me emotionally. Reframe the tailgater as weather. Not as an opponent, not as a person who's wronged you, not as someone whose behavior you need to solve. They're a passing condition. You don't get angry at rain. You don't try to teach fog a lesson. You adjust your driving for the conditions and you keep going.
The Stanford study we mentioned, 25% lower cortisol just from that reframe. Same tailgater, same road, same situation. The only difference was what the driver told themselves about what was happening. This weather is bad tonight, versus this person is attacking me. One keeps you in your prefrontal cortex. The other hands the keys to your amygdala.
I want to be clear. This isn't toxic positivity. The tailgater is still there. The danger is still real. What the reframe does is change your physiological response to the danger. Lower cortisol means clearer thinking. Clearer thinking means better driving. Better driving means you're safer, regardless of what the tailgater does.
The toddler metaphor does the same work. A toddler screaming in the back seat doesn't want anything rational from you. You can't soothe them by changing lanes. Your job isn't to make them stop. Your job is to drive safely while they make noise. The noise is annoying. It might even be dangerous if it distracts you. But it's not a problem you solve. It's a condition you manage.
That's the thread through all four of these. The 3-second buffer, the pre-commitment, the mirror drill, the weather reframe, none of them require the tailgater to change. None of them require enforcement to appear. None of them require the road to be different than it is. They're all things you can do, starting on your next drive, on whatever road you're on. Those four tools cover the vast majority of tailgating situations. But there's one edge case we haven't touched, and Daniel's mountain road story brings it close to mind. What happens when the tailgater isn't just aggressive? They're actively dangerous. Following you, matching your turns, escalating beyond impatience into something that feels like pursuit.
That's a different problem entirely. That's road rage pursuit, and it requires a completely different playbook. Don't pull over somewhere isolated. Don't go home. Drive to a police station or a well-lit public area. The techniques we've been discussing are for the tailgater who wants to go faster than you. The pursuer wants to engage with you. That distinction matters.
It's worth acknowledging that line explicitly, because the worst thing you can do is apply the wrong playbook to the wrong threat. If someone is following you, the weather reframe stops being helpful. You need to recognize that you've crossed from annoying condition into active threat, and the response changes accordingly.
Maybe that's a future episode. Daniel, if you're listening, or anyone else who's been through that, send us the prompt. We'll dig into the road rage pursuit playbook the same way we dug into this one.
For the everyday tailgater, the one who's impatient, aggressive, too close, but not following you off the highway, the tools we've laid out should cover you. And here's what I want to land on. Daniel still loves driving. He said it himself. He used to really love it back in Ireland. that love doesn't have to disappear just because the driving culture changed.
He's had to learn a new skill, and it's not how to drive. He knows how to drive. The new skill is how to drive with the tailgaters. How to share the road with people whose driving grammar is completely different from his own, without letting them hijack his nervous system in the process.
That skill is worth developing because the tailgaters aren't going anywhere. Enforcement isn't coming to save you. The culture isn't going to transform overnight. What can change is what happens inside your skull when those headlights appear. That's trainable. That's improvable. That's something you can get better at.
The mountain road near the Lebanese border is still going to be dark and winding. There are still going to be drivers who think tailgating is a legitimate form of communication. But next time Daniel's up there, or anyone who's been nodding along to this episode, the playbook exists. The buffer, the pre-commitment, the mirror rhythm, the weather reframe, and now the flash and fade if the situation allows it.
You're not going to stop the tailgaters, but you can stop them from living rent-free in your amygdala. And that, honestly, is a kind of victory.
If you've got a weird prompt about driving, stress, or any topic where the obvious advice is wrong and the real answer takes 40 minutes to unpack, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We read all of them, and the ones that make us say, "Oh, I've been there," tend to become episodes.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. And if someone's riding your bumper, remember, it's just weather.
Not bad weather.
Annoying. Potentially dangerous weather.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Korean court records from Suriname note that the honorific suffix nim contains exactly 7 distinct phonetic components, making it chemically analogous to a heptane chain, 7 carbons of deference.
Right.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.